Thank you, Vern. While they're switching that, Chris will be talking about the rim in the context of U.S. and international standards. Chris, shoot.
Thank you, Don. Like Charlie, I debated whether or not to bother with slides. At the end of the day, this dialogue, or dialectic, if you wish to call it that, focuses more around perception than an objective evaluation. So, given this title, I opted to share some information and some perception from the perspective that I think is pertinent. Let me begin, if I might, with, if my machine lets me. Well, we can do it this way. Some key messages. I think it's important that the community recognize that at the end of the day, HL7 is and remains a community of very diligent, very bright, very hardworking, very earnest people trying to do the right thing on a voluntary basis. That is the community at the end of the day. We'll talk later about how large it is and how big it is and so on and so forth. Its products and deliverables are continuously evolving. No one has claimed perfection. Quite the contrary. There is a strong emphasis on pragmatic solutions. In certain circles, that seems to be a bad thing. And finally, if you consider the consequences of any large software project, and particularly the documentation about that software project, being subjected to philosophical scrutiny, I think we would find many interesting things in the documentation of large projects that have evolved in human history. And to focus on that seems somewhat disingenuous, to put it mildly. I was asked, what of the RIM, particularly its future nationally and internationally? Well, there are a bunch of statements on this page. One of them is in blue. And that is that the RIM is a highly abstract model intended for consistent HL7 message authoring. I think most people could agree on that. It's actually an open question of whether it is or ever was intended to be broadly generalizable for healthcare, whether it is well-formed and internally consistent of healthcare information data in its present form and documentation today. Whether there is an implicit ontology that is, can or should align with it and enable ontological reasoning mechanisms. And I think there's no debate at all about whether or not it's a well-documented resource. It is a bunch of volunteers, after all, who, for the most part, have day jobs, I should point out. This is the RIM, this week's version. Let's not go over it in detail. Suffice it to say, it is a highly abstract model, rightly or wrongly, of the healthcare process. That at its root has acts in which participants pay roles as part of entities. And we can look at an instance with drug ordering. The question everybody asks is, well, is that all there is to it, just a bunch of boxes? And the answer is no. The RIM is actually a larger software framework where much of the detail, much of the substance, much of the domain content, if you want to think of that, is buried into, if you will, its vocabulary extensions. And we'll look at a quick instance of that. So the model of the RIM goes far deeper than those surface-level boxes. Those are but the veneer. And here's an instance of a RIM message. The whole notion of an order, this may be out of date, but it's got instance identifiers. It has authors, subjects, and performers that play the roles of certified entities, patients, and healthcare providers with entities being from practitioners, persons, and organizations. I don't want to dissect this, other than to say it can readily be serialized in an arbitrary sequence and turned into any arbitrary syntax that is suitable for a health information message. One can convert this to an ontologic basis. One can convert this into an XML syntax. It's separating the notion of a reproducible, consistent model from the notion of its implementation. That is the goal and purpose of the RIM in the context of authoring messages. Similarly, the whole notion of constraint is very clear. One can take this large highly abstract notion of an act, specialize it into an observation, specialize it into an observation order, a lab order, and then crossing the blue line of realms. In the United States, one can bind that lab order to LOINC codes, and in the UK, one can bind that lab order to SNOMED codes. It is the specialization and adoption and flexibility of the RIM that is its philosophical notion. One of the problems that people bump into when they first look at the RIM is they can't see what it is that they do in healthcare in those boxes. Part of that is because of its level of abstraction. There's a disconnect between what people expect and what they actually see. We could quibble about whether that's a feature. Let's not. It is the way it exists today in its current state of being. That high level of abstraction hides the ability to see what they're looking for. On the other hand, it enables, without much modification, the adoption of messages and domains that were not present at the table when the RIM was designed. And the poster child example of that is the whole genomics messaging environment. The fact that the RIM could, without any significant modification, absorb the elements and components of genomic information in the context of a clinical message is relatively remarkable, and I think a testimony to its level of abstraction, albeit we pay the price of hiding surface recognizable elements at the form of its abstraction. This whole notion of ontology alignment is an interesting one. There has, as Charlie pointed out, been a long-standing historical conflict between information models and terminology models. It was Angelo Razzimori who first pointed this out to me, anyhow, in the late 1980s, when he was talking about the whole notion of family history. Do you create that as a vocabulary composition element, or do you have a box with heart disease in it and the label on the box is family history, which is to say a modification of the semantics by a trivial information model? There was an explicit representation of this question since the tension between HL7 information models and SNOMED clinical terms as an implicit information model manifest in what's called the term info document or the terminology information model document, where members from both communities agreed to try to resolve this evident conflict by convention across those representations. And not that this is a solution, but here is a table drawn from a draft of that document, which merely lays out the logical options. You know, throw SNOMED out and use the HL7 solution to a particular use case context, throw HL7 out and use the SNOMED context for, or something in between. Those are the logical options, and that is the core of what the term info document is really all about, struggling to pragmatically resolve these difficult semantic issues in terms of interoperability. Hardworking people trying to do the right thing, working together in a partnership. There's other concern about the peculiar modeling language in which HL7 exists. It's often called an upside-down design. And this comes from, you must remember that the model for the RIM predated unified modeling language, the UML syntax, by several years. So what HL7 has done by tradition, historically, is to refine objects by creating them as a very rich, large-scale object, and then removing detail or constraining attributes to get down to where they want to be. This is in contrast with UML that adds attributes to get up to where it wants to be. Much of this conflict, if you want to think of it that way, from a modeling domain conventional tooling perspective, is being addressed with a wholesale redesign of the tooling and infrastructure. But that does not take away from the meaningful content that has evolved and emerged and remains in the RIM. So separating tooling from its underlying content is an important level of abstraction and something that is being done. I was asked to address where is it in the context of U.S. standards and international standards. As we know, many HL7 elements are integrated into the CHI recommendations. They form important core components of the interoperability specifications emerging from the Secretary's convened Health Information Standards Technology Panel, or Health Information Technology Standards Panel. It's a de facto information interchange within most health enterprises in the U.S. today, and it is proactively engaged in good faith harmonization with complementary standards, to name a few: NCPDP, which is the drug pharmacy community, X12 in terms of billing, finance, and understanding, and the ASTM-CCR partnership that I think has moved along after some rocky beginnings, quite harmoniously in terms of trying to reconcile and resolve competing ways of doing similar kinds of actions. Similarly, in an international context, it is true that it's been adopted as an ISO standard, and there's an ongoing dialogue to align components of HL7 with the SEN 13606 model for electronic health, the open air standard, as it's called throughout Europe and much of Australia. One of the first targets that has actually succeeded in that harmonization is agreement on the underlying data types across those two environments, which was no small task. The international uptake of HL7 is actually large. There are more members of HL7 as an international association than there are of ISO TC215, of which I am the oncoming U.S. national leader. There are many countries with an aggressive V3 RIM adaptation program, albeit not without difficulty. That is part of the task of going from an abstract implementation, abstract design to an implementation. Similarly, internationally, there are many projects that focus around the RIM itself, not the least of which is the Bridge Project. I see many Bridge people in the room, a collaboration across CABIG, FDA, and CDISC built on the RIM backbone to define an interoperable standard for clinical trials, be it in cancer involvement, be it in big pharma, be it in other things. And of course, the ongoing harmonization with DICOM as an image management environment and messaging environment for interchanging not only the details of an image, but the associated clinical aspects in partnership with HL7. So there are bottom line issues here that I think we should not lose sight of. When I chatted informally with Barry about these things in my past, you know, it's a baby bathwater kind of issue. Okay, there's some dirty water in the tub, but there are some pretty healthy babies floating around there. And lest we lose the whole thing, we have to recognize that HL7 engages a huge community. I dare say the largest community in the health information standards development world of bright, talented, hardworking volunteers. And I want to put the emphasis that these are volunteers. They hold, without question, the largest working group conference in health information standards development on the planet ongoing today. And these are the annual HL7 working group meetings where consistently more than 400 people show up for a week on a voluntary basis to contribute their intellectual capital, their insight, their understanding, and their domain knowledge to an evolving specification of how we can all work together. Nobody claims that the products are perfect. Quite the contrary. And we welcome and engage criticism of those products so that we can all make them better. That is the goal at the end of the day. It is a best effort available under a volunteer mechanism. There's a large amount of mostly coherent material. That's for you, Barry, that is available as part of this standard. So I was asked, what is the future? HL7, as we speak, is undergoing a thoughtful reorganization. Much of its tooling is being rebuilt and rewritten to be more concordant with modern information processing tooling. It continues to attract a very large critical mass of thought leaders, implementers and vendors, users and developers. It's capable of critical self-analysis and indeed embraces it, particularly when it's done in a collegial and complementary way. The evolution is ongoing, and it is likely to remain a vibrant, productive form into the future with the continuing contribution of the community. Thank you.